No, I've never been kicked out of a game, actually.
I'm trying to think if I have. No, I'm so charming.
Yeah, that's it. It's my 18 charisma that keeps me in. For the Mundangerous Alchemy Lab in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 30 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about Munchkins, the players who vex GMs more than any others. But first, the Morning Glory campaign causes disorder in the court, and the Mystic Theurge bends reality to her will in the Character Creation Forge. So we want to give a bit of a shout out to Lex Starwalker. We were listening to his podcast recently about XP in 5th edition and the way that the system just makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah, his show is Game Master's Journey. You can find it on iTunes. But he reached out to us on Twitter and said, hey, I'd love to hear you guys, you know, what you think of this episode that I did.
Oh no, we need to listen to another podcast.
Yeah, I think we mostly agree with him. He did a lot of the math on the encounters. One thing that he talked about at the beginning was similar to what we talked about when we were complaining about the Ranger, is that the three pillars of the game, the combat, social, and survival or exploration pillars, they're not evenly balanced. Mm-hmm. D&D does combat really well. It does skills all right. It does exploration poorly. So giving equal XP for those kind of things is similar to the way that we complained about the Ranger and how he can be the boss of exploration, but exploration is still a relatively unsatisfying pillar in the game.
Yeah, it's really hand-wavy. You can say, oh, one-third of your game should be exploration, and you know, maybe at your table it really is, but that depends on the GM sort of planning out all of those encounters and sessions themselves without that much advice from the actual DMG.
Yeah, and then you've also got this weird thing of the risk reward kind of thing, right? Why would you ever do combat if you can get exploration XP? Because there's no risk, right? I mean, that's just don't die.
I mean, there's always sun exposure, you know, that's pretty brutal.
Right.
Skin cancer, melanoma is really bad.
But no, he did the math. And one of the most revealing things to me, as you mentioned when we were talking before the show, an easier encounter, like one bugbear, will reward more XP than a more difficult encounter, like multiple goblins.
Now, first, let's say the bugbear's broken.
Well, right. That's the problem.
But in terms of, you know, the amount of XP that it's worth, yeah, that none of that makes any sense.
No.
Now, we often do the math, but we were sort of surprised when, you know, we were listening to him go through all the calculations, because we hadn't done this with the XP system in 5e, because very early on we realized, oh, this doesn't work. It's not a good way of measuring the difficulty of an encounter. It's not really a good way to plan encounters. So let's just drop it. And we didn't really look at it anymore.
Yeah, I think we probably did one session where you were gung-ho about using the DMG's encounter math, and we probably just rolled it, and you didn't even mention that you had abandoned it entirely.
Yeah. It also, the DMG encounter math, even if it did work, is based on characters with no magic items and no other special abilities.
Right.
So as soon as you hand out that first plus one sword, which most games are going to eventually,
because right,
it's not factored into the math of the game, suddenly it's not useful anymore. A deadly encounter becomes totally doable.
Yeah, that's, and again, I wasn't building the encounters for our campaign, but I get the impression that we were punching way above our weight class according to the book, which makes me think the book was wrong.
I mean, I purposefully gave you guys a lot of stuff because I wanted to sort of, you know, we were kicking the tires on the system. I wanted you to be able to try a lot of things out, but I sort of calculated you guys at being maybe one level higher than your actual sheets said. But unless a combat encounter was intended to be a complete speed bump, there was never a time that I threw anything less than low deadly at you. Deadly encounters like one or two levels above the threshold for deadly. I wouldn't give you high deadly because, you know, that sort of goes up infinitely.
Yeah, yeah. Right. You know, I think the encounter math works decently well up till 5th level. and then it completely fails to account for extra attack.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've got monsters that are making multiple attacks already. But once the PCs do that and level the ground, all the math is gone.
And then, of course, the DMG says 6 to 8 encounters per level, and just cramming that many encounters in takes forever. It gets boring.
Yeah, that was another thing that Lex mentioned on his show, was he wants to write a module to publish. And at the pace of play that Wizards of the Coast recommends, you know, which is roughly, you know, level from first to second level in 1 4-hour session, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I have to put so many encounters in, there's nothing else.
Right, you couldn't physically roll all the dice even if all you were doing was dungeon crawling.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's just not possible. So I recommend to everybody, stick with the plot and level up when it seems like they've earned it, when they hit a milestone, you know?
Yeah, and define milestone however you want. One thing that I was recognizing when I was deciding when to level you guys up was when you succeeded at some large task, you guys were like, we must have leveled up for that, right? But when you're counting individual XP for particular enemies, maybe it wasn't the big Dracolich that pushes you guys over. Maybe it's the bugbears you run into as a random encounter on the road afterward or right before.
Sure.
So it's a little odd. It feels a little odd and almost a little gamey to say, oh, no, you don't level up from that huge experience that has a big impact on your characters. It's from this thing that just happened to roll over another tens digit on this arbitrary number on your sheet.
That wandering damage really, really put us over the edge, right? The other thing for us is we were at the point in the game where combat wasn't really what drove us.
Mm-hmm.
We had to gather information. We had to uncover this plot. We had to figure all these things out. And we had existential threats that we were dealing with. It was much bigger than just, did we win this fight? So it almost seemed like it would have been unfair almost to limit us to XP only through those fights. So.
Yeah. At higher levels, there was a point where you guys were like, oh no, we got into a combat. That means we screwed up somewhere.
Right, right.
Or this is the combat we've been preparing for because we need to put this guy down.
Exactly.
That's the point of all this.
Yeah, it was either a showdown or it was a complete screw up on
right.
our part. All right, so speaking of the Morning Glory campaign, where are we?
Well, the party's been arrested and charged with kidnapping the entire nation of Seer.
That seems trumped up.
I mean, they weren't where they were before. So something happened.
That's true.
Think of it from their perspective. So you're in jail. The party is informed by their advocate, Kala DeKenneth, that the trial takes place in 3 parts. There's the trial by jury, the trial by ordeal, and the trial by combat. She informs you that you have a choice of the order it takes place in, but you're not going to be given any other information about what each part of the trial entails until you actually get to it. She also gives you guys a tidbit of information that Kallik's been asking about. He, of course, wants to know what happened to his pregnant wife. Well, it turns out she lost the baby, she became the captain of the guard of New Metrol, and about 10 years after the Day of Mourning, she was killed in an attack fending off undead.
This is 10 years here, not 10 years in our timeline.
So then you guys realize that there's some sort of slippage in the timeline. In fact, the Day of Mourning happened 25 years ago in the frame of reference of the residents of New Metrol.
Right. And what we learned was that the slippage of time was at the speed of plot.
Maybe. Maybe there's a chart. You don't know. We'll actually get into the minutiae of the trial next episode when we'll be discussing courtroom drama for the entire episode.
Sure. So let's get on to our main topic then. Munchkins.
They're the best part of the donut.
That is true. They are also one of the most vexing player profiles. I mean, go to any internet forum, go to Reddit, go to any convention. The horror stories are always about munchkins.
And we say this as people who have strong munchkin tendencies. I don't know if you've noticed.
I would like to say that we are conscientious munchkins.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I definitely think so. Maybe reformed munchkins.
Yeah, I think that's right.
When I was younger, I think I was probably way worse at it. I mean, both worse at it and worse about it.
I want to be capable to be a munchkin so that I can decline the power.
Yeah, and really, it's really helped me as a GM be like, no.
Right, right. I know what you're getting at. I'm not falling for that.
I respect it. I don't hate the player. I don't hate the game either.
But you're not doing that.
Right.
All right, so let's go back to our favorite resource on player profiles, Robin D. Laws's Robin's Laws of Good Game Mastering. This one seems to fit into the power gamer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is your character who wants to grow powerful, whatever that means in your system, and generally wants to find the weaknesses of the system to do so as cheaply as possible. And cheaply, I mean cheap in terms of costs, right?
Right. So there's always an opportunity cost for whatever you choose in-game.
Right. So the most efficient way to spend XP, right? No wasted levels, no wasted skills, that sort of thing. And in general, as Robin D. Laws mentions, he wants to put the game back in the term role-playing game.
As in something that can be won or lost.
Or solved, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
A puzzle that could be solved. And then I think you'll also see a Munchkin tends to have shades of a couple other player profiles, either the butt kicker or the tactician, which means they tend to be relatively combat favored.
Mm-hmm. Which we'll see actually makes them sometimes easier to deal with, because combat is the thing that a GM really has the most granular control over.
Mm-hmm.
So Munchkins aren't always a problem, are they? Or does someone become a Munchkin when they become a problem?
That's a good question. I think maybe they become a Munchkin when they become a problem.
Mm-hmm. And before that, they're just maybe a power gamer.
They're just a power gamer, yeah. So I think that's fair. So what are the general causes of problems with Munchkins?
I think the biggest one is when one player is outshining everyone else at the table. That's a big problem because everyone is taking this time out of their busy schedule to play this, and no one wants to show up and feel like they didn't get to accomplish anything, or the things that they did accomplish didn't really matter in the long run to the furthering of the plot or to defeating their enemies or whatever.
Right, yeah. You don't want one player to just hog the spotlight the entire time, right? Mm-hmm.
And of course, in terms of on the GM's end, if you want to balance an encounter for a character that's overly powerful, that's really difficult to do, to make it challenging for this player but not super deadly for every other character.
Yeah, that's the trick. And I think, you know, we were talking about encounter balance earlier. That was one thing for our group that wasn't a problem. We were all relatively even in power level.
Mm-hmm.
It was just that we were way more powerful than the book expected.
Which actually was totally fine, because that was really easy to balance. I just ramped up the encounter difficulty.
Right, but the challenge would have been if one character was sitting there and breaking the game,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think I came a little bit close to it. I was a little bit nervous about introducing Simulacrum as a spell, because then I could copy the abilities of any of the other characters or just have two of myself. And I was really concerned that that would become like overwhelming and start overshadowing the other players. So I ended up having to do that a little bit. Like I kind of left the gloves on for that. And I never made my Simulacrum kind of steal the show from me.
Yeah, you and I were talking outside of the game about, okay, Simulacrum is coming. How are we going to handle this? Let's both keep an eye on it. Because we were both invested in making sure that the Simulacrum didn't take too much table time or make things too easy.
Yeah, and we agreed that there was no way that Brand wasn't getting a Simulacrum, right? That was just the most efficient Brand.
Yeah, given his personality, of course that's what he would do.
Exactly.
Yeah, that or like clone himself or something.
Well, yeah, he never got the clone. That was poor backup plans, because I didn't read the book. Another behavior that Munchkins can sometimes exhibit that can be a problem is if they're quarterbacking.
Mm-hmm.
So especially when you get into combat, and I think the more tactical you treat combat, the more this becomes a problem of, you should do this because you are able to do this, right?
Mm-hmm.
The only way to do it is the best possible, most efficient tactical approach.
Right, the belief that there is a right move or a wrong move in any given circumstance for a given player.
Exactly. It's like they can't imagine playing a game of chess where the queen has a personality and feels bad about taking the pawns.
Right.
Right? The queen is a ruthless killer. She must be a ruthless killer. We are in combat.
And also, this quest for more XP or more kills or more gold can often lead to murder hobo behavior, especially if the Munchkin doesn't really view their character or the other characters as real people in a real living world.
Right. And not to say that all murder hobos are Munchkins, because there are plenty of non-Munchkin murder hobos as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably a whole different player profile that we should talk about. But that can be a problem of your Munchkin is built to fight, so he turns everything into a fight. Mm-hmm. And especially if you have the problem where you feel like you can't challenge a Munchkin, then that murder hobo just runs the game and it ends up ruining it.
Right. Speaking of turning everything into a fight, sometimes that happens above the table as well when the Munchkin turns into a rules lawyer because they say, no, this is what the rules say my character can do, and so you have to do that.
Right, right.
And that creates this adversarial relationship, not only with the GM, but other players at the table who are like, come on, can we just get on with it?
Yeah, like do your fancy Nova round, your crazy mind-breaking system ending. Like, can we just get back to role-playing, please?
Right. I'll also say one other caveat is that the Munchkin can make things boring for themselves at the table because they're not challenged.
Right. That becomes a problem. And I think maybe that's what leads to the rules lawyering or the murder hoboism, right? Is you keep having to push that limit to mm-hmm. entertain yourself as a Munchkin.
Right. You cross that next threshold of power and it's like, okay, now what? What's next?
Right.
So as a GM, what do you do when you've got a Munchkin at your table? What happens if Shane or Ishan shows up at a pickup game?
Oh, you kick him out.
Right. Sorry, guys, no.
Yeah, you just tell it politely, please.
But you hand them a pre-gen.
This isn't the first time I've been kicked out.
Nor will it be the last.
Yeah, so first you need to think, is this Munchkin actually a problem? Is he negatively impacting the experience of all of the other players? And if not, then don't worry about it. Keep trying to challenge him. Take some advice on how to challenge them, but let them continue what they're doing. Sometimes groups want to have a combat monster so they feel safe. Mm-hmm. And if he's willing to sit back when the group is role-playing or, you know, having social encounters and those sorts of things, great. Then it's just a division of labor. And as long as everybody's happy, it's not a problem.
Yep. Totally depends on the personality makeup of your group.
But if you've got that kind of Munchkin, you're probably in the very small minority. So what should you do second?
I mean, I guess you could talk to the player outside of the game.
Yeah, you definitely have to talk, because this is an above the table problem. This isn't an in-game problem.
Why is our advice always talk to the person?
Because we're hippies
who, oh right, yeah,
like story and conversation and stuff.
Can we suggest more passive aggressiveness? Notes.
Oh yeah,
notes on the refrigerator.
Don't renew your lease.
Yeah, sometimes all it takes is to just remind someone, hey, I think maybe some of the other people are feeling like they don't have a lot to do. And normal people will say, oh, I didn't notice that. Thanks for pointing that out. Let me fix this.
Yeah. And sometimes you just want to be acknowledged, right? Sometimes it's nice to know when the GM comes and says, hey, I was not ready for that. You win this round, right? So sometimes you just want to feel, hey, yeah, you know what? I won, so I'm good.
Right. That was super impressive. Maybe we don't want to have that happen every session. So think about something else. Good job.
Yeah, I'm going to mention this again later when we talk about what to do if you are a Munchkin player. But do your trick once, right? Mm-hmm. Let it be, save it for the right moment. Let it be awesome. And then don't go back to the well. Like, you know, beat the game and move on. It's okay.
Right. I will say, as a GM, make sure that when you are explaining your reasons for why your Munchkin player should tone it down, it needs to be more than just, I don't like it. Have a real reason that backs it up. So for example, I'm in a play-by-post game where it's a Star Wars play-by-post game. We're playing Saga Edition. I'm playing a Force-sensitive character, and in that edition of the game, you can use the Force to send an emotion or like a one-word message long distances. So of course, I'm thinking, all right, if you can send a one-word message, and you can do this at will, then you should be able to send entire messages either in code, or let's say I send the word up and that means dash, and I send the word down and that means dot. Over a long period of time, you should be able to send complete sentences.
Why would you not just send dash and dot? Those are just words.
I was trying to make it a little less gamey.
Okay.
Or sun and moon or whatever. And I said, okay, within the rules as defined, this should totally work. And the GM came back almost immediately to me and said, you cannot send Morse code with the Force. And the reason he gave was, okay, imagine if this was a movie, would this be boring for you to watch? And I said, yeah, you're right.
Extremely boring.
I would not want to see this in a Star Wars movie. I accept, yes. I'm going to add Holonet Transceiver to our wish lists. because I do want to be able to transmit messages over long distances, but I guess we're not using the Force for it. Totally fine.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's important too, is when you talk to the player, be open to them changing their character.
Mm-hmm.
If you've built towards something that you just don't want to be in your game, for example, if you're doing the Bardic College, right? When you use simulacrums and you just daisy chain them together to gain 30 followers that are all you. If you're building your character towards that and the GM says, hey, I'm not comfortable with that. All right. So let me make some changes, right?
Like, right.
Because if I can't do that, then I don't really want Simulacrum anymore. And that's actually a bad example because you still want Simulacrum.
I mean, it's happening in a Rogue Trader game where you don't want, is it Warp Speed?
Yeah. Yeah. Warp Speed is a
crazy strong psychic power.
Crazy powerful biomancy power. Yeah.
And Angelo, who's playing our psyker, Flair, totally agrees. It's way overpowered, but he was building toward it. If we change it or nerf it or he decides to take something else, of course you're going to let him pick different powers that were leading up to it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, if he went down that tree and then I took that away from him, I'd totally say, take the XP back, right? We'll just retcon what happened in the past. It's fine, but let's build towards something else then. But I think we're going to just end up fixing it and making it useful for him.
Yeah.
We've probably got some time before he gets there, so I'm not too worried at the moment.
And honestly, you and I probably want to make it stronger than he wants to make it.
He would, yeah. All right, so that kind of hints to our third recommendation, is to start designing around the problem, right? I think one of the biggest challenges for this is that it requires some system mastery, and it requires knowledge of the players and their characters. You need to understand the niches that they fill, the mechanics that they use, and then you've got to know the broader system so you can identify what are the problem areas, right? Is he exploiting the action economy? Is he taking advantage of skill buying or something in some strange way? Is he minimizing his flaws, taking flaws that never come into effect so he can get more benefits, right? Right.
So maybe those flaws will start coming into effect. Maybe you'll face creatures with legendary actions so that they can actually respond.
Right.
Maybe you'll face creatures with very specific immunities.
I mean, that's what happened in Dark Heresy, is I just started using monsters with step aside so that they could dodge more.
I mean, okay, you were using them on Dark Eldar, which makes sense. If you start having a bunch of orcs with step aside.
Yeah, I know. They're just going to have to sit and take it. But they're orcs. They'll be fine.
Right. So yes, you can target the Munchkin's weakness. Now, this should be used sparingly because you don't want to go totally to the other side where you have a player showing up and they just feel like they're getting beat on every session over and over again.
Yeah, it's a tricky one to balance because in some ways, if you're targeting their weaknesses, you're actually shining the spotlight on them, right? This is one of the tips that you gave me when I started GMing for our group. You said, remember, it's not just who's making the action in their turn. It's also who's getting attacked, right? So when somebody is threatened, they feel a better part of the game. So an easy way to bring somebody back into combat is say, hey, I'm attacking you, right? And usually that leads to non-ideal tactics on my part, and I rarely focus fire for that reason. I try and spread it around so you guys are all engaged, even when it's not your turn.
This reminds me of episode 5, Alternative Combat Objectives. In general, you should be designing your encounters so that every character has at least one job they could be performing.
And one of those jobs, or maybe multiple of those jobs, is hit things and kill them. Right? And that's a fine job to have, but there should be something a little more diverse as well.
I've talked about my 4E character before, my ranger, actually, whose job was kill the things, you know, because obviously 4E combat was already a slog, and he was highly optimized toward once per day killing one thing in one round.
Sure. So if you're the Munchkin, then I'm going to give you that target, and I'm also going to give a mob around that target that's strong enough to pose a threat to the other characters. I know what you're going to do when you act, so I've got to give something else for the other characters to interact with that isn't the big bad.
You mean like
a bodyguard or an honor guard or a second in command?
Or it can also be something totally non-combat related.
Oh yeah, like shoving a princess off the cliff. My favorite alternate combat objective.
She's in another castle at the bottom of this mountain.
No, she's not in any castle anymore.
she's in transit.
You just missed her, but if you hurry, you might catch her.
So your combat spec'd character is going to feel a bit like their XP points were not necessarily spent in the right place when suddenly the objective is not to kill something quickly, but to move, fly, or catch.
But one thing to keep in mind, that character's probably still just going to kill the bad guy. You've got to also account for him continuing to do what he's doing.
That's true.
So drop the princess off the cliff, but be prepared for the person holding her to die, I would recommend.
And sometimes you can have those different combat objectives happening in different places.
Yeah, I actually recommend splitting the party.
I mean, anytime you can get the party to split up is great as a GM. Yeah, okay, sure. If you want to.
Yeah, I'm using the example, right? Let's say that there's a general within a fort, and you've got to assault the fort and kill that general. Maybe the munchkin is leading the charge at the gates so that the rest of the team can get behind enemy lines and sneak in and kill the general while they're all looking towards the frontal assault. Mm-hmm. That's what he's good at. He's the munchkin. He can mow down waves and waves of enemies, and he can breach the outer gates, and he can do all of those cool things. And you can go, okay, what do you do now? All right, now party. Where are you going? And you can just keep switching back and forth, and it creates a fun scene. There's this tension of, we have to win in both places, but he can only affect one, right?
Yeah, and in this instance, the party is depending on him being really good at combat.
Right.
Go out there and do it. It's a tactic that works well, even if you're not dealing with a munchkin, right? If you have a paladin and plate armor, let them go make the challenge to the army, you know, on their own,
right,
while the rogue sneaks around back.
Yeah, we had one of these situations in our original Dark Heresy game, if you remember, when we assaulted that warehouse, and we had to take out the guards that were outside of the warehouse, and it was this total wet work moment, right, of us, like, sniping, and then the two of us were running up and trying to confirm the kills, right?
Right.
And in case we missed, we didn't want them to vox to their allies and tell them that they were being attacked, right? Mm-hmm. So we had this cool thing. I don't even think we fired a shot in anger. All our characters did was run rooftop to rooftop checking the guards. But it was still fun because, you know, there was the tension of the negotiation that was going on inside and our sniping going on outside.
Right.
And we were ready. I mean, we were ready.
This is what we were literally built for.
Yeah. And then you can do the converse, which is use enemies that are weak to the munchkin's allies. So make him... give the other characters a chance to shine directly. And that takes the spotlight away from the munchkin. He can still do what he's going to do, but if the other players are also now mowing down enemies, they're going to feel great as well.
Yeah, if one of the munchkin's allies is a paladin who's dishing out, you know, a decent amount of radiant damage, then you can have an enemy that is resistant to all damage except radiant and necrotic.
Yeah, exactly.
However, this can be a little risky because sometimes it becomes an arms race. You know, if you close a door for the munchkin, their personality means that they're going to try to find a way around it.
Yeah, they're going to go through the window.
So this may mean that they just go out looking for more broken combinations.
Yeah. What's that old term that necessity is the mother of invention?
Maybe race to the bottom.
Right. You can definitely run into this problem where you're having this back and forth where you keep having to throw higher and higher level challenges at your munchkin player to keep that person engaged. And then you just end up leaving the rest of the party way behind. Mm-hmm. They just can't keep up with those challenges.
So I think one of the good ways to deal with that is to sate the munchkin's need for success or character optimization a little bit here and there. Give them something that they can work with that makes them still feel like they're getting what they need out of the game. So support optimization when it doesn't do any harm. I feel like some GMs get too wedded to their personal idea of what a normal character should look like. But remember that the PC is pretty much the only design space that a player actually gets to use. And the munchkin specifically wants to be able to design well within that space. So, sort of like we mentioned in the first place, if it's not really a problem, just let the munchkin do it.
Yeah. Multiclassing is that perfect example of this, right? Where some GMs just don't allow it. For no good or bad reason, just... No, I don't like multiclassing. I think it's for power gamers, so I don't allow it at my table.
Right.
I don't see it as a problem, so I'm always a bit taken aback by those hard rules, you know? I mean, fine, I'll play a single class character, but it just...
Bard 20.
Yeah, exactly.
Great, I will break your game with Bard 20.
Right, the paladin still exists.
Yeah.
You know, like, I can still tear apart your combats, you know? But when that balance isn't a huge problem in a system like 5th edition, so what if you have to multiclass four times, as we recommend in the Character Creation Forge today, actually?
Yeah, that tends to make a character weaker in the long run anyway. But I think as we've proven in a lot of the forges, it's necessary sometimes to get an iconic ability that really fits the vision of a character.
Yeah, yeah.
And in an unbalanced system, that optimization is often totally necessary in order to make a character that is even usable. Think 3.5 melee characters.
Or 5th edition rangers.
Yeah, and that's another thing. Don't be too afraid of splat books. If at some point we actually get some more options for a ranger, if you're one of those GMs who says, no, we're only using core, we're only using the first book because that's too many options, then you're always going to relegate those rangers to being second tier classes.
I mean, be wary of splat books, right? Power creep is a real problem, but you have to really look at them on a single basis, right? And I think that underlines all of the recommendations we make, is that you want to be inclusive of the player in this discussion, mm-hmm. right? Don't hand down decisions from on high and demand that they adhere to them, because they will totally work around the letter of the law. But speak mm-hmm. to them about the problems you have, the concerns you have. I bet they will design a character that works just so that you don't challenge them on it, right?
Right.
You know, you say, look, I'm worried that this is too powerful. He's going to go out of his way to make sure it's not too powerful, right? It's going to be powerful, but just powerful.
Right. It becomes a cat and mouse game of like, where is this GM's line?
Right. Exactly. Which, I mean, is fun for Munchkins sometimes,
yeah,
right? I mean,
yeah.
That's a game. It's like its own little meta game, and that's fine. I mean, if that's fun, that's fun, right?
Mm-hmm. And when you are making these changes, or if you have any house rules or tweaks to particular things in the game, try to stay consistent. You know, the Munchkin will inevitably attempt to design around it. So just be clear about the reasons you are allowing or disallowing particular exceptions. Remember that you're setting a precedent.
All right. So what if you are a Munchkin?
It's fine. You're okay. You're a good person.
Well, hang on. Didn't we say that Munchkins are only Munchkins if they're a problem?
Oh, right. You're
terrible.
Isn't
he literally a problem?
Power gamers are great. You're a problem.
Yeah. No, it's okay. So we have some recommendations for you.
Mm-hmm. From reformed Munchkins.
Yeah.
These are things that helped us.
The very ones that we adopted ourselves.
Yep.
Right? So the first one is, rather than just looking for raw power, look for a specific niche.
Right. Be the best at something that no one else is doing. Or something that's actually really difficult or requires a lot of resources. I guarantee you it is super rewarding.
Look for those off-the-wall character concepts that shouldn't work in the system. Like, that's basically the Character Creation Forge, right? Is what we do, right? Sometimes we're designing for specific ideas, and other times we're just like, can we even make this work?
Right, is this possible?
Right, like, let's talk about a mounted combatant, right?
Let's build a monk that doesn't use dexterity.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's a really great outlet as an optimization exercise that doesn't end up overshadowing other players or the enemies.
Yeah, you know, I love the Blade Warlock,
mm-hmm.
because the Blade Warlock is a bad melee class, right?
Yeah,
the Warlock
really is
just better off being ranged.
Mm-hmm.
There's a ton of trap options, and you've got to be careful about what you pick. That seems to me like the perfect challenge for a Munchkin. Like, be the best Blade Warlock on the planet, right?
Yeah, you're not going to hurt the game because
right,
you top out pretty early.
Exactly.
But you're still going to be a ton of fun because Blade Warlocks are so much fun.
Right.
Or just odd ability score combinations. In almost every edition of D&D, I like to put together a melee wizard. Because why not? That's super cool. Strength Int, that's a fun character to play.
Yeah.
Or you can fight with one hand tied behind your back. For example, the 4th edition Lazy Lord that never made an attack roll and that ran everywhere because it didn't matter that, like, you couldn't hit.
I mean, that solves your quarterbacking problem too, right?
Right, exactly. And I will say, sometimes these open up new opportunities for design spaces, right? When you give up certain parts of a character to focus on another part of it, suddenly you say, oh, wait a minute. Like, I don't even need any armor. Armor doesn't help me at all, for example. So now that I don't have to wear armor, there's a lot of other options open. Maybe I take Monk 1.
Yep. And then the other piece of this is just look for something that the party doesn't otherwise have, mm-hmm. right?
And that they still need.
Yeah. So if everyone else is a melee combatant, maybe don't be the best melee combatant and outshine them. Maybe be the best party face.
Mm-hmm. This is a nice opportunity to be the diplomancer.
Okay.
Well, maybe not
the diplomancer.
Maybe a diplomancer. Be high charisma and be good at diplomacy. How about that?
That's so be brand.
This works really well with sage characters. No one is ever threatened by the research savant.
No, but it's very useful in
super useful
in a lot of campaigns, right? You mm-hmm. better prepare the rest of your party for it.
Yeah.
Talk to your GM. I guarantee if the GM has identified you as a munchkin, tell him you're going to be the researcher. Mm-hmm. He'll be all right.
Yeah. Like, wait, you'll get all the answers and I don't need to dangle plot hooks in front of you idiots?
Yeah. I just get to tell you lore about my world. I'm in. I hope you roll all nat 20s.
Right? I had 3 sages in Morning Glory, Brand, Lou, and Emery. Oh, it was amazing because I got to just put together these handouts and old scrolls and hand them to you guys and be like, read these because you know it.
Right, right.
You can also choose or simply just invent flaws or character traits that end up limiting your own power.
Yeah, this is going to feel unnatural to a munchkin, but consider Batman doesn't kill anybody.
Mm-hmm. He could.
He's perfectly capable, mm-hmm. but he won't.
And that helps define him as a character. It also sort of gives rise to a lot of the ways he's found to get around that. And mm-hmm. that is a really great intellectual exercise.
Yeah, you've now become the knockout artist mm-hmm. because you have limited yourself from killing things, right? And that's probably a bad example, actually, for D&D, because it's hard to build a character that isn't just going to hit you with a sword until you die and then say, okay, wait, I took him to 0. I don't kill him.
Episode 4, the pacifist.
Yeah, it's the pacifist.
Or you could be a sorcerer who maybe their family was killed in a house fire and they refused to use fire spells, even though those are often some of the best ones.
Yeah, or I mean, even things like the storm sorcerer, you're choosing a less powerful elemental focus, right? Mm-hmm. Thunder and lightning damage is generally weaker spells.
Yeah. You can also have secret abilities. Every time, well, almost every time that I play a Star Wars character, they're force sensitive, but they're secretly force sensitive, mm-hmm. especially, you know, in Rise of the Empire eras. So they have all these amazing abilities, but they can't use them or they can't use them openly.
Openly, yeah.
And honestly, that's tons of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say as far as flaws are concerned, you have to also play your flaws, right? Mm-hmm. I think for systems like GURPS where players choose flaws at creation to get more points, that's one of the biggest complaints about munchkins is that they take a flaw, but they never seems to show up when they play their character, mm-hmm. right? So if you're taking, only one eye, right? Maybe you don't make the perception check. You say, hey, no, this time I just missed it. Like, I'm not even going to roll. Stuff like that where it matters.
Right. Yeah, especially if you're in a group with other characters that are good at perception. Why would the guy with one eye be keeping the lookout?
Right.
Just focus on tracking or whatever it is, the other thing that you do.
Yeah, and when it's desperate and the party needs to make it and everyone else has failed and you make the roll, that's an awesome moment for you, right? Mm-hmm. It's miraculously, he's never noticed anything before, but our one-eyed guard, he was on point today.
Right.
And then I talked about this earlier, but I'll reiterate it. Use your tricks once. We mentioned the Diplomancer. We mentioned the Bardic College. That's cool exactly one time, right? Mm-hmm. It's okay to do your, what was the jump diplomat?
Oh, right. Like you jump half a mile in the air and then everyone converts to your side.
Right. Because
yeah,
you're,
that's 3-5, right?
Yeah. Because you can trade out your one, right, you one skill as, for another skill or whatever.
You can
yeah.
use anything as diplomacy.
Yeah. 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 So
or jump as diplomacy, I believe.
Yeah. So that's cool one time. It's funny when you pull it off and everyone groans. If you start trying to do that every single game, people are going to be incredibly frustrated.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to be super bored.
And yeah, you've already solved the problem. Move mm-hmm. on, you know, find a bigger problem.
Right. Or maybe a different problem.
Fair enough. Start working on that novel you've been putting off.
Another thing that really, I think, helps that whole munchkin bug is realizing that helping other players can be just as much fun, especially these days when you don't have to be relegated to being the healbot. You know, in 4th edition, they were called leaders. It's one of the reasons that I really like to play warlords. It's a great way to help new or less mechanically inclined players experience some of that thrill of, you know, having an amazing combo or rolling a giant fistful of dice.
Yeah, because your character is just directing them to do it, right? You're using your action to do that.
Mm-hmm. And it really, I think, takes a more seasoned player to appreciate that hey, I gave everybody plus 5 to damage throughout the entire encounter. And honestly, that probably ended everything 2 rounds earlier and saved us a bunch of damage. Now, you're the Munchkin. You can do all this math. You've probably crunched all these numbers. You know how effective that was. Revel in that. Be happy about that. I also think party optimization is a ton of fun.
Because I worry about this one, but I'll let you speak your piece.
All right. So it's not about being better than the other players, but it's about being better than the enemies. So it prevents other players from feeling overshadowed. It's easier for the GM to balance the encounters because they just increase the difficulty, which they're going to have to do anyway in 5th edition, especially once they have some magic items or depending on particular party makeups. So, for example, you're the artificer who makes all the magic items for the party, or the programmer and hacker who 3D prints them all in the van, or the nubby requisition expert who makes all of those commerce rolls and gets everyone good gear. Nobody is upset when the bard is overpowered because they're handing out D12 inspiration dice so that people don't get hit or do a bunch more damage.
Okay, so I will agree with you in that regard. If you're giving things to the party as a character, I think that's great. Where you have to be careful when you say optimize the party is you don't want to overstep your bounds as a player recommending what other players do with their character.
Yeah. Out of character party optimization, I need to keep that on a tight leash. Only when people ask you.
Yeah, if somebody asks, help. Or if they've made a trap choice, maybe explain that that could be a trap choice, right? And if they say, no, you know what, that's what my character does, that's what I want to do for my character, fine. You just have to accept that and maybe make them a magic item.
Right.
It's funny because you did this as the DM for Emery.
I did.
We were way too high level and she was still using a crossbow, I believe.
Yeah.
And so you just gave her a legendary bow and optimized her right up the chain.
Suddenly she could make 2 attacks per round instead of 1.
Right.
And of course, Munchkins, remember rule 0. The DM makes a ruling, stick with it. Ask for rulings first. Ask for them proactively and make your case for whatever it is that you want to do. You know, is my idea totally crazy, or is it just crazy enough that it's super cool?
Yeah, and if you ask for permission, you're way more likely to be allowed to do it, right?
Right.
It's when you blindside the party, and especially blindside your GM, with something that's completely like garbage mechanical mumbo-jumbo, that's when everybody goes, oh, okay, you're Munchkinning again.
Yeah, like if you had suddenly whipped out Simulacrum at the table and said, oh, and my Simulacrum also makes one, I would have been like, let's talk about this after the game. But yeah, because I knew we were purposefully, you know, we had decided on a limit already, I wasn't going to say no Simulacrum.
And I do think if I had needed to make an extra Simulacrum, and we had a reason, right? We were preparing for a fight or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think you would have let us do that.
Yeah.
If it was for that. But if it just became standard marching order that Brand walked around with 30 other brands.
I mean, yeah, if you were going to do the Bardic College,
right.
I would have been like, I probably would have figured out an in-game way for it to totally backfire. Because, like, they're you, so they're...
Yeah, it's actually...
It's Calvin
it's
and Hobbes.
It's Calvin and Hobbes. It's when he gets the cloning machine. And they're all as lazy as him, and yep. No one will do his homework, and they yep. all get him in trouble.
Right. They all killed each other fighting over the one headband of intellect. So exactly. Enjoy. It's just ice and snow in your room.
I love that I handed a headband of intellect to my simulacrum. And then it was like, oh, yeah, that was a really smart thing for you to do.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
All right, I'm going to do your thinking for us.
I'm going to do our killing. Okay, right. Great.
All right. Do you hear that, Ishan?
Yeah, that's the sound of my spreadsheet calculating DPR differences between a Frostbrand and a Flaming Sword. I'm also determining the likelihood of encountering each fire-resistant creature in the Monster Manual based on our projected campaign arc and the relevant minis in our GM's collection.
Okay, it's also the sound of the Character Creation Forge.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But before we get to the forge, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sans Carne, that's malice minus meat.
You can tweet at the show, at TPTcast.
And if you can't fit it into 140 characters, you can email us at totalpartythrill@gmail.com.
And last but not least, you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com.
So this week we're building the Mystic Theurge. For those of you who played 3.5, you know that it was an advanced spell casting prestige class that increased your caster levels in both wizard and cleric at the same time.
Oh, yeah, that sounds balanced.
At low levels, it was actually pretty weak because you take like Wizard 1 and then Cleric 1. And in 3-5, all that meant was like you have the abilities of both, but you didn't get any more spells as a wizard. You didn't get any more powerful. You're splitting your spellcasting stats.
Yeah, it was like Darwinian character class balance. Like, that character probably isn't going to survive to 5th level. Right. So we have to worry about it?
But if you could get past that to the point where you were now advancing both classes at the same time, you became insanely powerful in the end game.
Okay, so what's our build for the Mystic Theurge?
Fortunately, thanks to Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide, we can go Arcana Cleric 17, Wizard 3.
So this makes a lot of sense to people who are familiar with multiclassing, because it is typical to have 3 levels of multiclassing for spellcasters, because you still get 9th level spells.
Mm-hmm.
But why Cleric 17 and not Wizard 17?
Excellent question. So if you are a character that operates at the highest levels of both divine and arcane magic, we felt like you needed not only wish, but also 9th level cleric spells.
Mm-hmm.
So the Arcana cleric gets to choose a 9th level spell as one of their, a 9th level wizard spell as one of their domain spells. So you're going to get probably foresight, maybe true resurrection, depending on, you know, what direction you're going in. But then you also just choose wish, and now you've got both.
Or you could take true polymorph.
Also true.
Become a gold dragon.
That's right. The other thing that this allows us to do is with 17 levels of cleric, we've got a 17% chance of getting a divine intervention.
Right, which is the proto-wish ability of the cleric.
Mm-hmm. With no drawback.
Right, that has a low chance of success equal to, you roll a d100 and you have to roll your level or lower,
mm-hmm.
Your cleric level.
We could have gone to cleric 20 and then gotten 100% chance of success on that, because that's the capstone ability. But it felt like that should only really go to a character that is wholly devoted to a god.
Yeah, agreed.
And then also we got some great stuff out of Wizard 3.
Yeah, so this is an int-wiz build, right?
And there aren't any races that are just straight up int-wiz. So high elf is nice because you can get intelligence and dexterity and you get a free cantrip. Gnome is good because it's +2 intelligence, and then half elf and human are fine as well.
Mm-hmm.
When you take that first level of cleric, part of the arcana domain is that you get to choose 2 wizard cantrips. Make sure that those are damage dealing cantrips, because they count as cleric cantrips for you, and later on you get potent spellcasting, which lets you deal extra damage on your cleric cantrips, but not your wizard cantrips.
Right, and those damage cantrips scale with their damage.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, so Firebolt is possibly the most raw damage. You could also consider one of the melee, one of the, you know, Blade Singer type ones.
Mm-hmm.
Green Flame Blade, that's the one I'm looking for.
Or Booming Blade, because later on you'll take Warcaster and you could potentially use those on a opportunity attack.
Right. So we get to 3rd level of Wizard, which means we have to make a school choice. Which schools do we recommend?
We think there are 2 potentially really good ones. The first one is divination, because we talked about before the portent ability, which lets you roll 2d20s at the beginning of a day and then replace any d20 roll, yours or someone else's, with that roll sometime during the day.
Yeah, we had a listener question about that, and we think that is a nice ability. It's quite powerful.
Yeah, and it's really useful if you have a low roll. You can use it on your enemy's saving throws, mm-hmm. and guarantee that they fail.
And then the other option is evocation, which has the sculpt spell ability.
They automatically succeed,
oh,
and
that's right.
They don't take any damage if there was damage on a half, or any effect on like a miss. Those work great for a bunch of different cleric spells that have area effects. Think Flame Strike, Blade Barrier, Firestorm, Earthquake, and then of course any wizard spells that you might take. I mean, it's cool just to think of, now you're a cleric who can drop all of these spells right at their own feet, and there's just a hole where they are.
Right.
It doesn't hurt me. And especially with these high ones, it doesn't hurt anyone in the party, because you can restrict quite a few other creatures from it. It also means that you don't have to worry about friendly fire, especially because you're a cleric and you probably don't want to hurt innocent people.
Right. Yeah. You're just going to be the one to patch them up afterwards anyway. You might as well cut out the middleman.
Right. And remember that the arcane recovery that you get from Wizard works for spells of any class.
Yeah, that's super handy. Mm-hmm. So we're going to get a 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th level wizard spell as a result of the Arcana domain. So what do we recommend?
Obviously, level 9 is Wish.
Or True Polymorph.
Or True Polymorph.
If you're going to be a munchkin. Yeah. What about level 6?
I like Disintegrate because it's super handy and it takes out all of those force spells.
Uh-huh.
Contingency is also really nice, I think.
See, I wonder, would a cleric who perhaps is also devoted to healing, would he take Disintegrate? Would he use a damage spell that's unrecoverable?
See, that's interesting. Now, you might want to take Disintegrate and then make sure your cleric ninth level spell is True Resurrection.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
You don't need a body then. But also, it could be handy for totally destroying undead.
Yeah, that's true.
And the contingency is just nice to have.
Yeah, so contingency allows you to cast another spell alongside it and set parameters for when that spell is actually resolved.
Right.
So common uses would be, when I hit 0 hit points, I want a big heal, please.
Or if I die, revivify me.
Revivify me, right.
Or teleport me elsewhere. Go home.
So we have talked about this already quite a bit, but for 7th level, we recommend Simulacrum.
Yeah, it's just too handy.
It's, yeah, and getting to extend your resources like that is super useful. Mm-hmm. Though I actually recommend Teleport or Plane Shift as well. Those are both super handy spells, though certainly not as raw powerful as Simulacrum.
Right. You do, as a domain spell, already get Teleportation Circle, so decide whether you also want the additional, but all of those spells are super useful.
Yeah.
It also really works well for a research character, Simulacrum, I think. You just leave them at home and then they search the library.
Yeah, yeah. That's a nice sage ability. Mm-hmm. And maybe give them an intelligence headband.
For 8th level, maybe anti-magic field, although maybe you don't want to have handy access to something that makes you pretty much powerless.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's a little dangerous.
Do you want the nuclear launch codes?
Right. Right. Although think about it this way. You can wear armor because you're a cleric. So if you're fighting an enemy spellcaster, maybe you get up next to them, you drop anti-magic field, they're completely useless.
And you can just start beating
them. Pound them with your fists yeah. or your mace.
Yeah, don't forget, you're still a cleric.
That's right.
And that means something.
I also really like Demiplane because I feel like this kind of character, again, they're research focused. They're playing the long game. Every day you just increase the size of your Demiplane just a little bit.
Yeah, that's fair. That's kind of a fun spell, right? And a very roleplay-ish kind of spell. Mm-hmm. It's got some escape abilities in terms of, you know, quickly getting away from things. I don't think of Demiplane as a particularly powerful spell.
It's not.
Because I think 8th level spells are terrible. And that's why I took all of the 7th level spells when I built Brand. It was just, why would I wait? Like, I would rather use that slot on a powered-up spell of lower level. So, you know, you have to take an 8th level spell as part of the
right, rules. You can't take a lower level spell, unfortunately.
Right. So Demiplane is the fun one that we recommend.
Mm-hmm. And then as for feats, we talked about Warcaster, but the other big one would be Ritual Caster, which means that I would probably choose Wizard because that has the most interesting rituals, and you'll be able to cast any wizard spell with the ritual tag as a ritual because it's based off your full character level and not your wizard level.
Yep.
And that gets you things like Find Familiar, which is nice. Like, why wouldn't you have a familiar?
Wait, don't you already have a familiar as a wizard?
No, you have to get the spell.
But you can, I mean, you could just go get that.
You could, but then you don't have to use up your
small
amount of spell slots, right. You know, like for knowing it.
Wait, what?
Oh, yeah, I guess you could just go
buy
it. You
just have to write it down, yeah.
Yeah.
Wizards don't have those restrictions.
Okay, well, it lets you get the higher level rituals because in your normal spell book, you're only going to be able to put up to, I think, level 2 spells.
Yeah, especially if you're the divination wizard, mm-hmm. if you're a diviner, you'll still have access to some of the higher level, or rather the mid-level ritual divination spells.
Mm-hmm. Like, and you'll be able to pair those up with the cleric versions that you can just cast normally.
Exactly, exactly. So what's your background as a mystic theurge? How do you end up dabbling in both the arcane and the divine?
I like to think of those devoutly religious people who also have a strong scientific bent. And if you think about sort of the Renaissance or even pre-Renaissance, a lot of the times the people who sort of had the leisure to do scientific research were people who were working in the church.
Sure.
So Mendeleev?
Yep. Copernicus, I believe, before he was excommunicated.
And if you think about it this way, in traditional Dungeons & Dragons, the gods are real and obviously real. It doesn't make any sense not to believe in them. I envision a character who believes that divine spells and magic are subject to rules the same way that arcane magic is. Maybe they don't see a distinction between them. Perhaps one is conjured by particular gestures and another is conjured with a particular kind of faith in a particular god. But honestly, you need particular gestures for those divine spells as well.
So you're trying to prove that magic is magic regardless of the source.
I think that works, particularly for a knowledge-based deity, I think.
Okay, that's interesting. I guess I would take the opposite. I would take the arcane caster who has an epiphany, who recognizes that, you know, there is a deity out there who encourages his exploration into arcane rituals and those types of things. So he begins worship of that deity, and through that worship, he begins to learn as an Arcana Domain cleric, right? He can continue to grow more powerful as a wizard as well.
So maybe they take one or three levels of wizard and then go to cleric.
Switch over. Yeah, exactly.
So basically Elminster.
Yeah.
I got an offer I can't refuse.
Right. I mean, you could even go far enough to say that he's ambitious. He would like to become a god. And he sees this as his path.
This is definitely one way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Gold dragon.
Right. All right. If you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And if you're willing to help us out, we'll read your 5-star review on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher. It's like a Pandora for podcasts. If you like or favorite us there, the algorithm will help other people find us.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about trials and court proceedings.
I think that'll dovetail nicely with where we are in the Morning Glory campaign.
It's almost like it was planned.
Right. And in the Character Creation Forge?
The Factotum, the master of many skills.
All right. Well, that's it for episode 30 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.